Some years ago, Eric Weiner suffered abdominal pain. The writer and former NPR correspondent ended up in the emergency room.
And this nurse walks in, and she sees I'm scared. I mean, I was just reeking of fear. And she bends over to draw blood or something like that, and she whispers in my ear these words I will never forget. She said, "Have you found your God yet?"
Doctors eventually found nothing wrong with Eric Weiner, but the nurse's question about finding God made him wonder if something really was wrong. He'd previously written a book called Geography of Bliss about a hunt for happiness, and now Weiner began another quest to find religion. He wrote a book on his experience called Man Seeks God, and he came by our studios to talk about it. You had this prompt to explore your own faith and try to find out what it was, but you grew up Jewish. Why not just go in that direction, go a little more deeply in that direction?
Well, I grew up as a very specific kind of Jew, Steve. I grew up as a gastronomical Jew, which is basically bagels, lox, gefilte fish. You know, if it were edible, then it was Jewish and supposedly had something to do with God. I'm really not kidding. And you're right, I could stick with my heritage, but it just struck me as that was a bit of a cop-out. If I was going to answer this nurse's question, then I needed to look as broadly as possible.
Now, as a Jew, you went first naturally to Islam.
I dove headfirst into Islam for a couple of reasons. One is that this is the 800-pound God in the room, right? I mean, everyone has an opinion about Islam, even if they don't express it. But I couldn't look at all of Islam. As you know, it's this huge religion that spans many sects and many regions. So I chose the one that appealed to me the most, and that's the Sufis, the mystical sect of Islam.
In the end, Sufism didn't seem to sway you. It wasn't the end of your quest in any case.
It was not the end, but I have to say I loved whirling like a dervish. I took lessons in whirling.
How does one whirl like a dervish, if you can describe that on the radio?
Well, very carefully, it turns out. It's not really a dance. It's a spiritual activity.
Are you actually whirling? You're spinning like a figure skater on one toe?
Yes, you are in one place, and the really serious dervishes will practice on a nail so that their foot stays put on that nail as they whirl. I didn't do that. But the idea is that it's prayer in motion as you're turning. You're sort of praying. You're in what they call zikr, or remembrance of God. They say if you're close to God, you don't get dizzy. I nearly lost it. I was so not dizzy. So I guess I have work to do. But I did, for that briefest of moments, experience what it felt like to turn effortlessly. And then, of course, I announced to everyone who was watching me, look, I'm turning. It's amazing. And then promptly nearly fell over.
Oh, it's the being conscious of yourself that caused you to do that.
Well, Rumi, the great Sufi poet, said, never analyze enthusiasm. And I made that mistake.
So you continue further east, get into other religions. You end up in Kathmandu, the capital of Nepal.
I do. I was diving into Tibetan Buddhism. There were several hundred thousand Tibetan Buddhists in Kathmandu. And I was seriously in search of a lama to teach me Buddhist meditation. And I was looking, and I couldn't find one. And finally, someone suggested to me, have you considered Wayne? And I'm thinking, well, which part of Tibet is Wayne from? And they said, oh, the Staten Island part. So I'm thinking, well, this isn't really why I flew to Kathmandu. But it turns out that Wayne of Staten Island had been living in Kathmandu for 30 years. He was an accomplished Buddhist and meditator, and I agreed to work with Wayne. So every morning we would climb up onto his roof in Kathmandu with the Himalayas in the background, and I would attempt to still my monkey mind, as the Buddhists call it, this tendency for our minds to dart around and to never stay in one place.
So you're not whirling this time, you're trying to be still.
Well, my mind is whirling, but I'm still.
Okay.
And we worked at it and worked at it, and I'm sitting there and I'm trying to just watch my breath. And this worked for about 3 seconds. And then my mind starts to obsess about, for some reason, nail clippers. I didn't bring any with me. And I become concerned, I mean, seriously concerned, that my nails will grow to these sort of Howard Hughes-esque proportions, that there are no nail clippers in all of Kathmandu.
So as soon as you try to empty your mind, random anxieties fill up that space right away. That's what happened to you.
Things, and this is what I discovered on the spiritual journey, is that things often get worse before they get better.
Why do you write, Eric Weiner, that as you explored more and more religions, you actually became more depressed?
I think it's what's known as a karmic reckoning. This idea, you know, that as you dive into this stuff, you're really familiarizing yourself with your mind, the Buddhists would say, with your heart, the Sufis would say, with God, the Christians would say. You know, it's like ripping off the bandage and you realize there's this gaping wound on your arm or in your chest. And you're like, oh, my God, I've got a terrible wound there. And then ideally, as you go about a spiritual practice, you start to do something about it.
Did things get any easier when you went to New York City to spend time with Franciscan friars?
Yes and no. Easier in that I was on my home turf now, on more familiar terrain in the sense that it's Christianity. And that comes fully loaded in its own way. Sitting in Catholic Mass as a Jew, a gastronomical Jew, but still a Jew, attempting to cross myself and just doing it all wrong, and my arms are flailing every which way. But, you know, living cheek by jowl with them, as I did for a while, I saw what good work they did running a homeless shelter in the South Bronx. And they've taken these vows of poverty, chastity, and obedience. Now, I've experienced two of those, chastity and poverty, in my life, but never voluntarily. And here they've taken a vow for all three, but they never felt in denial. You know, I would ask them, you know, wouldn't you rather have the latest iPhone? Or, you know, I just had this impression that they woke up every day really having to suppress these basic human needs for things like sex and stuff. And they were not like that at all. They had made a choice. And they felt basically that by having, say, no stuff, they didn't have stuff to worry about. They didn't have to worry about upgrading to stuff 2.0 or people stealing their stuff. In a way, it's very liberating.
Let me ask about your own journey then, Eric Weiner. As you go along through these various religious practices, you say at one point when you're being asked to believe something, my disbelief refused to suspend itself.
Right.
Did you end up, in the end, with something to hold on to?
No, I didn't. I'm sort of holding on to a lot of things at once. I think it is possible to create a sort of IKEA God, some assembly required, you know, this idea that you can cobble together your sort of own personal religion, a sort of mixtape of God. What I conclude is you need a foundation. And in my case, that is Judaism. I did come back to the spiritual aspect of Judaism, Kabbalah, and find that I need that foundation. But on top of that foundation, you can add all kinds of things. So I'm sort of in perpetual seeker mode, but I think that's okay.
Eric Weiner is the author of Man Seeks God. Thanks very much for coming by, Eric.
Thanks so much, Steve.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Lynn Neary. Warning to parents, the next story contains some seasonally sensitive information on the subject of Santa, so beware if there are any young ones nearby. As everyone knows, Santa sends helpers to malls all over the country around this time of year to find out what children want for Christmas, like these kids who visited one of Santa's mall proxies in Athens, Ohio over the weekend.
I want Barbies.
A train track.
The movie Song of the South. Walt Disney made it.
An M3 player. And flip-flops.
Ultimate Optimus Prime. And that DVD called Scooby-Doo's All-Star Laugh Olympics. Volume 2, it's a guarantee. That's all I want.
That was Braden Neese, Elise Smith, Brianna Neese, Derek Wilson, and Gracie Hanna. Usually the most challenging part of representing Santa is cajoling the shy and comforting the scared. But this year, even Santa's workshop is being hit hard by the economic downturn, and that means some kids may not get everything they want. So one man has been working with some of Santa's helpers to teach them how to gently limit kids' expectations this year. His name is Fred Honorkamp of the Charles W. Howard Santa School, and he joins us now. Welcome to the program, Mr. Honorkamp.
Thank you, Lynn. It's a pleasure to be here.
So tell me, have you noticed any difference in recent years in what kids might ask for?
We have. Children are little barometers of their environment. And they'll put a hand up to Santa's ear and whisper something like, can you get Daddy a job? Or can you help us sell our house? And in each of those cases, we say that we can't get Daddy a job. We can't sell your house. What we can do is Mrs. Claus and I know that you're going through a tough time, and we'll get down our knees tonight and say a special prayer just for you and your family.
What about when kids ask for really expensive things?
Well, we try and manage the expectations. First, Santa never promises anything. I weave in little stories about the North Pole. A child, for example, asks for an iPad, and I'll say, oh, I wish you hadn't asked for that. And they'll say, why? And I'll say, well, have you ever been to the North Pole? Well, of course not, but up there we have Building 2. You go out of the main lodge, and the snow is very deep. You go down to Building 2, and that's where we do our electronics. And the little elf that's making the iPads is an elf named Rupert. And guess what he's doing? And the child will say, what? He's playing with them. We're way behind production. I don't know what I'm going to do. I don't think we're going to be able to fill the iPad orders.
And that works, huh?
It does work. But we've also seen the flip side of the economy. Boys and girls come up and say, Santa, we know that it's difficult for some families this year. Would you please bring my presents to somebody who can really use them?
Oh, how sweet.
It is. It's just heartbreaking. Just the other day, we had a young boy that came in, and he said, Santa, can I get a new pair of sneakers? And I thought it was one of a list of presents, and I said, oh, wonderful. What else could I get? And he said, that's all. If you can just get me a pair of sneakers that don't hurt my feet, I'll be happy.
Oh, wow. Now, what about parents? Do they sometimes send Santa signals about whatever their situation might be?
They do. You can see them in the background, and when somebody asks for the new Nintendo 7000, you can see a parent shaking their head from side to side. And that's a clear indication for Santa to weave a story around how we're having technical difficulties with the Nintendos this year.
Yeah. Well, it was fun talking with you this afternoon.
I wish you and yours the very best for the holiday spirit.
Fred Honor Camp helps Santa's helpers get ready for Christmas with his Charles W. Howard Santa School in Midland, Michigan. We turn now to Washington and presidential politics. Most of the Republican presidential candidates were in town today, addressing a group of Jewish Republicans and affirming their support for Israel. Here's former House Speaker Newt Gingrich speaking this afternoon.
In the Gingrich administration, the opening day, there will be an executive order about 2 hours after the inaugural address. We will send the embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem as of that day.
NPR's Ari Shapiro has been at the forum all day. He joins us now. Welcome, Ari.
Hi, Lynn.
So what were the major themes of the speeches today, Ari?
Well, if I had to sum up the single message of this forum, it was, Israel, we Republicans love you more than President Obama does. Among Republican presidential candidates, it is an article of faith that the Obama White House has been too soft on the Palestinians, too hard on the Israelis. A few of the candidates used some version of the line, this president treats our friends like our enemies and our enemies like our friends. The most recent incident they point to is something that happened over the weekend with the U.S. ambassador to Belgium, who said that the Palestinian-Israeli conflict is one reason for anti-Semitism. Now, the ambassador has expressed regret for that. The White House has backed away from those comments. But Newt Gingrich says the White House needs to fire the ambassador. Mitt Romney says they're throwing Israel under the bus. And, you know, I should mention, the White House strongly defends its record on Israel, saying, as President Obama put it at a fundraiser in New York last week, he said, this administration has done more in terms of the security of the state of Israel than any previous administration. But at any rate, those are the battle lines, and it's pretty clear which side this Republican Jewish crowd stands on.
Well, what do the candidates say about how they would support Israel?
Well, you heard what Newt Gingrich said about moving the U.S. embassy. Michelle Bachmann later said she would do the same thing. Mitt Romney says the first foreign trip he would make as president would be to Israel. He contrasted that with President Obama. Here's what he said.
Yet in 3 years in office, he hasn't found the time or interest to visit Israel, our ally, our friend.
You could hear there were some boos and hisses in the audience there. There was also former Pennsylvania Senator Rick Santorum, who talked about a little tile from Israel that says, pray for the peace of Jerusalem, that hangs in his kitchen, and he prays over it every day. Former Ambassador to China John Huntsman talked about the work he did in Beijing to push sanctions against Iran. And Texas Governor Rick Perry talked about his many visits to Jerusalem over the last 20 years. Actually, Iran came up a lot, and all of the candidates were very hawkish. They urged regime change. They said they would not hesitate to use military force. The Obama White House has not ruled out military force, but these candidates were much more emphatic about it. The only candidate who has not taken these positions in the Republican presidential field is Ron Paul, who has a libertarian view about a small military footprint. He has criticized American aid to Israel, and no surprise, he was not invited to this forum.
Hmm. Well, why is it so important for Republicans to address this group?
Well, you know, Jews are actually a very small portion of the American voting populace, and Jews overwhelmingly vote for Democrats, or at least they have in every past election, and looks like they're likely to do so as well in this election. But support for Israel is also an important litmus test for evangelical voters, and evangelicals could be hugely influential in the primary. And looking ahead to the general election, even a small shift in Jewish votes from Democrats to Republicans could make a big difference in swing states like Florida and Pennsylvania. So this is an important crowd for the Republican presidential candidates.
And obviously a crowd that is very critical of President Obama on Israel and other foreign affairs. How widely held is that negative view?
Well, this is actually one area where President Obama does his best in polls. A recent Pew survey said that 75% of Americans approve of the way President Obama has handled foreign affairs. 48% of Republicans approve. Some of that has to do with the death of Osama bin Laden, the end of the war in Iraq. You know, the U.S.-Israel relationship is not high on the list of most Americans' concerns, and even foreign affairs is not at the top of the list of most Americans' concerns. Obviously, that would be the economy, and unemployment is the number one issue for most people. But for this crowd of Jewish Republicans today, for many of them, Israel is the number one issue, and the candidates did not disappoint in their statements of staunch, unwavering support.
NPR's Ari Shapiro, thanks for being with us, Ari.
Good to talk to you, Lynn.